In 4DJC, W4DJW.
Good afternoon, Dave. How are you doing today?
Just killing some time, doing some programming. How are you holding up?
Just trying to stay close by the house as everyone else is. Been able to go through some stuff inside the house we've been meaning to get unpacked and that sort of thing. My wife's mother and dad passed away within a year of each other, actually last year. So we still got a lot of stuff we have to get through here that we packed up and brought home. So it's given us an opportunity to do that. And we did get to see our grandkids today, although it be at a distance out on the highway. But I guess that's an important thing to do. At least that's what we're thinking anyway. We can maintain our supplies. I think we'll be doing okay.
Yeah, that's the key. I ordered some masks and gloves to be able to go out, rubber gloves and mask, but it's like 3 weeks before they get here. Well, anyway, you guys are probably doing about the same thing everybody else is doing, just holding their own, holding the fort down while we wait this thing out.
Fortunately, we had some gloves, and we hadn't been able to find any masks, but we did find, because the company in Charlotte is making a reusable mask that can be washed up to 30 times. They usually make socks and that sort of thing, but they've got some type of antibacterial. It's not like an N95 or anything like that. But it's something just good enough to get you in and back, but you can't wash them, which is unusual. Well, I've noticed them on the news this morning. I ordered three of them. They're about 30 bucks a piece, though, but they are washable up to 30 times. So that may be a benefit if you're just, if you just have to go out occasionally. That may be some benefit. But the N95 is just about impossible to find right now.
That same thing I saw when I looked out on Amazon. They redirected all of the N95s to hospitals and healthcare workers and. I also saw where they rerouted a whole bunch of them that were bound for Germany back to the United States. But I've been reading up on what the guys in New York are going through. I've got a couple of workers up there in New York, and they're just staying in their apartments. They're not going anywhere. they're more restricted than we are. But none of the guys that are on my team got it yet. So that's a good thing. They're still able to work. They're just waiting it out like everybody else. But some of the things you read, posts about nurses and what they're going through, it's awful up there right now. They think in another 8 days they'll be over their peak, and that'll be a good thing, start coming out of this the other side. I think August the 27th was their worst day. It's like close to 700 deaths in one day.
Stays warm, but I'm not so sure. I'm not real sure whether it's airborne or not. I would hope that it's not, but you never know about such things. I'm on my handheld right now. I had it hooked up to the beam. I didn't know if I was getting into the repeater solid or not. I can get back on the other radio, but I've just done a little experimenting today.
No, you're perfectly readable. There's a little hiss in the background, but it's not a distraction at all. You're not crossbanding. You're just how much power are you? Is that handheld starting to get hot?
Right now.
Okay, well, you ought to be able to go for quite a while on a watt. I don't know what my handheld does on EL, extra low, but it won't make it to the repeater on EL. But it'll make it to it on L.
Expensive Kenwood 2-meter rig and, I'm running through a little 5-element portable antenna I've got upstairs. I use it on my regular rig, too, but I was just seeing how low I could go and get into it pretty solid. And as I said, this will run 5.5 watts, but it'll get a little warmish with a rubber duck antenna on it when you start transmitting on 5 or 5.5.
That's the way my Yaesu is. Actually, with a fresh battery, you know, that's not too old, and I've had to replace it several times. And when they're fresh, you can go for quite a while on high power on the Yaesu. It's an older model. It's not one of those new ones. It's not the color screen, but it does have the external GPS mounted on it. But it gets toasty in your hands if you run at high power for over about, you know, between 5 and 10 minutes. It's getting warm to the point where you don't want to hold it in your hand anymore.
I don't have a dual band handheld. I've been thinking about getting one, but I'm not real sure what I think. Well, I had a D-74, but that thing was so complicated. It was just, I've been a Yaesu guy most of the time for handheld since the early 90s, I suppose. And that new one they've got it on sale right now. It's got the GPS and APRS in it. I was even thinking about one of those, but I'm not sure if I want to make that leap or not.
I think I know the one you're looking at. I've probably looked at it a half a dozen times, but never pulled the trigger on it. That's because I got more handhelds than I know what to do with. The one I use the most is the VX8R. That's the one that'll get hot if you run it on high power, and it'll last for quite a while on high power. But that's on a rubber duck, and that explains why you're getting in with a watt if you're going off of a Yagi. Looking at, it's got an 1,800 milliamp hour battery in it. That explains why it goes so long. Thought about hooking a LiPo up to them and just have a LiPo like stuck to your belt and then plugged into the AC, not AC, the DCN, external power on it. But I've never done that. But I don't run apers on it anymore either. I used to leave apers running all the time on it, and it would run through a battery in a day. So I finally decided, use the off the power supply on a different radio for apers that runs all the time. Anyway, it was kind of fun in the beginning.
Those Baino batteries, but mine's a 12-volt, 9-amp hour slug. They weigh about 2 pounds, a little heavy to put on the belt. It does real well, and it'll run my 710 pretty easily up to 25 watts or so, but I usually don't run more than 10. But I've got one. It's a LiPo, but it's kind of a different configuration battery. You have to have a special charger for it and that sort of thing. But the one I got does a good job, but it's small. It's not about 2x4. It's not much bigger than a whole lot bigger than a deck of cards. But it is bigger, but it's small. It's 4x2x something. This heavy, it weighs about 2 pounds, I guess. But it works real well, and I'm sure they make a smaller version of that too. But I thought the next time I get a handheld, I'll be sure and just get the DC and have the wires. Because they do have a power supply here, that does give you some flexibility.
Well, I was on the road. I've got a bunch of 1.5-inch square by about 6-inch long. Drone batteries, multirotors. They're 6 amp hours apiece, 6,000 milliamp hours, and they're a 6-cell, which 6 cells on that, I think, I don't know, up around 20-something, 26 volts or something like that. Step it down to 12 volt, or step it down to whatever these guys take. At that amperage and that voltage, yes, 7.4 volts is what they take. Then, and those are really light. They're made for flying. They're lithium polymer. And they charge in an hour. you can go from dead to fully charged in an hour, but it takes that special charger like you were talking about. You've got to charge them up. And those are something you could strap to your belt and in your back, and you wouldn't even notice it was there. So if you had to go for long periods of time, I was thinking that would be ideal. And once those batteries get to where the cells don't stay exactly equal all the time, they're not good to put on a multirotor anymore because it drains them really quick. It'll drain that 6 amp hours down in about 12 or 15 minutes, and they're pretty toasty when they come out. Whereas the drain that a handheld would put on them at full power out would be negligible compared to what they're used to going through. W4DJW.
Yeah, that's definitely an idea. I'm thinking that the Yaesu 3 I think, and I had a VX6R PAC that I kept for a long time. That was a really good radio. It was sealed up well and, you know, real durable. And it lasted, it seemed like the battery, and it lasted a long time, too. It was kind of squat, stubby, like the short squatty, like the newer ones are as well. But it did not have the internal GPS with it. The new one that, you know, you and I both have probably looked at is that 3DR, and that one has got a touchscreen on it. That's the, we got access to a keyboard. I just don't know how durable the touchscreen keyboard will be, but I'm sure it would be okay. But all I know is the DC-74 Kenwood I had, it would eat through a battery in a short period of time on the Apris as well. And plus, since I didn't have it on an external antenna in the car, it was kind of a waste of time to run it like that.
Kind of like the 8R, the VX8. All right, I've got the 7 and the 8. I haven't had a 6. Steve had a 6 when he used to come over here. He'd bring it, and he liked that radio a lot, the Yaesu, the VX6. And I got a 7. I never use it anymore. I used it for a long time, like you used your 6 for a long time, and then I got the 8, and now it's obsolete. They don't even make them anymore. That's the downside of being in this hobby for so long. You get all this obsolete equipment. All this new stuff comes out. If you don't keep up, you get behind.
I know this Kenwood, they've been making this Kenwood for probably at least 5 or 6 years. They just don't, you know, the D-74 is the first new handheld they've had out in a number of years. I think the D-72 was the one prior to that one. They just don't change as often as Yaesu, and no, actual Icon doesn't change theirs very often either, but Yaesu, you know, they used to... It was like the radio of the month that was there for a while, but I don't know whether they're doing it now or not. But I know that I've had excellent service out of all the Yaesus I've had. I think the first one, the first nice 2-meter rig I had was a Yaesu, either a 207 or 208R, and that's been back in 79 or 80, I guess.
Well, I had the Kenwood THD-7. I had one of those, and I used it with the Kenwood 2000 for what's called Sky Command or Sky Control, Sky Command or something like that. It worked really good for that, but got where I wasn't doing HF near as much as in the past and quit using that. But then I came across another one. I got two of them now. Robert had one at the at one of the ham fests he was selling for about a third of what I paid for the first one, so I couldn't pass that up. And what my plan was there is to use two of those mounted on the rotor, on the X-axis and Y-axis. Use one of them and follow the satellites and have the Raspberry Pis track the satellites with the downloaded positioning that you can download position days and days ahead. And then have one of those... doing the uplink and the other one doing the downlink, and then cross-banding over to those from the ham shack radio, the TS-2000, so that the rotor could turn any angle, any position, with no wires attached to it, all one self-contained unit, and no coax cables, no power cables, no nothing, right? It was free to turn any angle it wanted, go around in circles 100 times without getting wires wrapped up, and cross using wireless to cross-band to both the Pi, right, remote in on the Pi with the Wi-Fi, and remote in on the radios with the TS-2000. That was my goal. I never really got that far before I fried one of the drivers on the Raspberry Pi that controlled the stepper motors on the rotor. And then I got distracted with all this repeater stuff, and I haven't been able to get back to it yet. I want to wrap this repeater stuff up so I can get back to that.
High tech low dragons I've ever heard. That is really, that's a great idea. That's Sky Command. I'm not very familiar with it, but you know, for a while the D-17, you could actually control it remotely with like a 2-meter Kenwood rig. But the one I have is only below a certain seal, above a certain seal number. They remove that that feature from the radio, and it really made it, you could turn it on or off and scan, you know, do the channel scan. It wasn't actually cross-band repeat, but you could operate it remotely. If you were doing a cross-band repeat, you could activate or deactivate it. You didn't have to leave the station basically unattended. And I think you could do that. I don't think it was meant to access repeaters that way because of the ID requirements, you know, we discussed, you know, earlier. That would have been a cool situation without having to deal with all the coax and all that sort of thing and controller cables. I mean, there's so many things you can do with these little Raspberry Pi, especially a computer anyway, situations now. If you know what you're doing, you can do just about anything. If you got the time to do it and set it up and have the knowledge to figure out what goes where.
W4DJW, that's what made that, that was a challenging project. It made a lot of fun. I've got to order some new drivers for it, stepper drivers. The ones I got were off the internet, and they were for those 3D printers. And it just wasn't quite enough to be hoisting a big antenna around because it would do fine as long as the footprint of the satellite on the Earth was like skimming over a like one edge of it. It was, what do they call that? Cosecant, it crossed over 2 points of, you know, not tangent, but not crossing over the center. But when that satellite came directly overhead and the rotor was tracking it on elevation going up on one side, then it would have to spin around 300 or 180 degrees really fast to track it coming down the other side when it went directly overhead. And it would spin that axis, the azimuth axis, really fast. But it wasn't like a brutal hammering it, but it would it'd ramp it up really quick and then it'd ramp it down really quick. And I think that's what toasted the stepper driver. They were fine as long as it was going off to the side like no more than 45 degrees. But when it went directly overhead, and a few of those was all it took, it let the magic smoke out.
DJC Friday, yeah, I can imagine so. The vertical, you know, the near overhead passes are, they're easy to hear if you have a, you know, vertical type antenna or a flip or if you got a handheld beam. But when it comes to something fixed, it's really difficult to get to overhead ones. And not only that, the footprint is so, you know, well, actually the footprint, you're better off going at about 20 degree, at a 20 degree angle if you've got the line of sight. If it's within your line, if you can see the horizon, the true horizon, and if it gets about 20 degrees, so that's actually, I think, you know, from what all I've seen and been able to decipher on my own, that that's probably a 20, 25 degrees is probably better because you have a little better chance of working some guys out, you know, outside, you know, 4 or 5 call zone, you know, getting into. There's one guy here in Mexico on a regular basis on through the satellite and through ISS, and he's got a huge station in Mexico. I've got him a couple of times, but he's one of these guys. He's on all the time, it seems like. But I've seen some of the steppers, homemade stepper solutions for some of the antennas to track the single antennas, but not for the. For the deal, and also the some of them are just a little easier to work than other ones, but I can imagine that'd be a mess. The more I look at it, the deal rotors and that sort of thing is probably the way to go, but it's just that's a lot of work, and you got to do a lot of homework to get those things set up right, and you have to be in either a QTH where you got a tower, or you got to be able to get up high enough so you can get a clear shot at the horizon. Otherwise, you're spending $1,000 or so for something you can accomplish with a lot less money.
Yeah, that's the thing. I watch the, there's a lot of guys got YouTube videos with their dual antenna, their dual Yagi. It's got 70 centimeters on one 90 degrees, and on the other 90 degrees, it's got 2 meters. And they're out there in a field, and they've got a handheld. And I guess they programmed the memory channels to be just a little bit further, you know, to adjust for the Doppler effect. They've got it the same frequency plugged in multiple times so that they can just click, 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 click and compensate for the Doppler effect. That's one of the things the TS-2000 was able to do really good is it's got a satellite feature on there. And you can just plug that thing in, and it'll do this radio frequency shift for you while you're doing the azimuth and elevation tracking. It's just a lot to remember, a lot to keep in your head. That's why I wanted to button it down with the X and Y axis rotor with the antennas mounted on it. But it got there was a lot of cables on there, and the programming, you had to say, okay, if I've made 720 degrees so far in this direction, I can't just keep going. I got to stop, and I've got to start going back around the other. So you had to keep up with your total, your absolute quantity of degrees that you had rotated, because you knew there were coaxes wrapped around that vertical axis. And but it got to where it worked really good. It would do that, and it would wind up, and it would unwind. I'd leave it running overnight, just tracking satellites that were coming over. And wake up the next morning, it wasn't like transmitting or anything, but it was tracking them, and it was running all the time. It ran for about a half a year like that before it finally fried those stepper drivers. But it would just all of a sudden wake up, and you know there's a satellite coming overhead. You could go look it up on the screen to see which one it was, and it just track it the whole time. Kind of a cool project. I want to get back to it.
That'd be a top-end station, you know, for satellites to have that ability to do that sort of thing, because it's not the odd thing about it, Dave. I think of some of these radios that are, unless it's actually designed as a satellite radio, I mean, the DT-710 is a quasi-satellite radio. It's not, it doesn't have the ability, I mean, you can cross-band on it, that sort of thing, but you know, you have to be able to tune both of these, you know, two VFOs at the same time. And some of these won't let you program UHF, you know, transmit. It's hard to get it to cross band on multiple frequencies. And that's one of the reasons a lot of the guys seem to like the uplink on, the downlink on 2 meters and uplink on 70 centimeters, because you have to, you know, the downlink, the 2 meter downlink, not quite as effective by Doppler, evidently, as the 70 centimeters, so they can tune it up and down. Anyway, it is confusing, and different satellites, you know, when it goes to different modes, it's really confusing. There's a lot more work in it, you know, outside of some of the real simple ones. There's a lot more work in it than people realize, and the guys that are consistently active on it do well. They have good stations, and they've just got a whole notebook full of settings too, I'm sure.
W4DJW, that reminds me of how when I was trying to figure out how it works, I did put it on a software-defined radio, and you can control it too, its frequency. And the data files that I was getting for each one, I think they had the frequency shift for when they're on the horizon, when they're directly overhead, and when they're on the other horizon. And I'd calculate, you know, how much frequency, how much I had to move it for the speed, because the speed increases as it gets overhead and decreases as it gets closer to the horizon. So you'd have to calculate that in there too. But you could, on a software-defined radio, you could see the trail as you were changing frequency, or as it was being used on the downlink, as it was talking and you were getting it on the downlink, you can see that on the waterfall, and it drifts off to one side. And you can tell if you're on it or not by if at the top of the waterfall it is where it's currently outputting is the frequency that you're on for your input. And where it's been is further up or down one side of the waterfall. That's how I figured out if I was tracking it correctly or not, if I had it exactly backwards or right on. Fun times, W4DJW.
What's out there right now, Dave? Probably the ICOM 9700 is one of the better radios. Just got the waterfall display. it does all three bands as well. So, and plus you've also got upper and lower sideband for the linear satellites, which is a whole different ball game entirely. But that's $1,400. I mean, that's a lot of money to spend on just the radio. Then you got, and not only that, it doesn't. And it's got three separate antenna connections in the back, which means if you run, if you're running a 440 or more, and excuse me, 70 centimeters or 2 meters into like a single beam, that means you got to have a diplexer. Yeah, that'd be a I wouldn't think of it. I want to say a diplexer. I'm not sure if that's correct, whether that or a duplexer. You'd have to run one or the other in order to get it to run off a single antenna, then, which is a little simpler if you're, outside with a, you know, with the elk or with the arrow, which has got the 70 centimeter and 2 meter, you know, horizontally opposed to each other. That one works real well too, but there again, there's just a lot of. I mean, you're lucky. I guess you got more science you use in, the more technology you use, the more efficient and effective you're going to be. But I guess some of us are just lucky we can get into it at all.
That's absolutely true. Some of those guys, you'd hear them on there, and they make a contact or two, and you'd hear other guys just struggling away. But I was into it more for figuring out how to do the technology than the actual communication piece of it. I like that discovering how it works, because I've always been curious about how that works. And then once you get, it's kind of like when you write software, you learn a process, something that you're totally unfamiliar with. You learn that process really good when you write a program that does what it's supposed to do. You actually know exactly how it's supposed to work. That's one of the reasons I like writing code, because it teaches you different technologies. Because you got, if you don't know the technology, you can't write the code, right? Or you can write the code, but it's not going to work right. But have you ever done one of the satellites that uses 23 centimeters, 1.2 gigahertz?
About just a second, Dave. I'm going to go ahead and drop back to the other radio so I don't run the battery completely out on this. But no, I've never used 1296.
Okay, W4DJW, standing by.
Back on now. I had to swap out the antenna to the 710 to be sure I didn't run the battery completely out on the 2 meter Kenwood.
Yeah, it still sounds good. It sounds a little bit better, a little bit less white noise in there than before. But I had to send one of my TS-2000s back to when they had a repair place over on Virginia Beach. I cooked the finals in it, so I had to send it back to them. And while they had it, I had them put that 23 centimeter module in it. But I never have used it yet. I was just curious. So I was going to get to that, but couldn't use my handhelds. My plan for putting two handhelds over there for when the downlink was, the uplink or downlink was 23 centimeters. But that would have been fun, because I had one of those antennas that I used for video for the multirotors. So I already had the antenna. I just needed something to transmit and receive with. And now I've got that plugged into the TS-2000. But there again, project switched over in it before I got time to test it out.
My brother-in-law is engineer, and he worked for Lucid, Bell Labs, all that sort of thing. He works at Georgia Tech now, and he's a fiber optics guy, and he became a ham about 25 years ago, I guess, and he was doing some of that higher band stuff that in 1296, and they even had, they had a couple of repeaters in the Atlanta area where you live that but he said you really had to have a line of sight to be able to do it. But it was just one of those interesting technology things to do. He said he'd get on top of a building sometimes, just microwave back and forth to each other at a spot. I think they used, I don't remember if they used a Yagi type antenna or they used a dish for some of the work.
I think on the multi-rotors, I've got a Yagi for that, but I did see where other people had flat panel antenna. I don't know what they call those, but those appeared to work pretty good. And then they also had dual dishes, two dishes side by side, that worked pretty good. But I always just used a Yagi, and it worked good. As long as you respected the, for every mile you went out, you had to go a tenth of a mile higher in altitude. So if you were 10 miles out, you needed to be 1 mile high. and that put a lot of strain on a multi-rotor for batteries. But with an airplane, that wasn't so bad, especially the larger airplanes with the gasoline fuel. They could do that pretty easy. Some of those went out like 50, 60 miles.
I wasn't aware of that. But all of those, it had a lot of loss, and they did some work on people. I guess it was before they got into the cellular technology. They did some work on higher bands than that. He was doing it. He works on like unmanned vehicle type situations too for the DOD. And they've got a lot of technology that is just really interesting. Some of it he can't talk about, and some of it he can. Some of the stuff he can't talk about is really interesting. Some of the things they're doing. And I was amazed that you were talking about using your drones. I was amazed. That's some of the things he's working on. I was amazed at how many. He was telling me about the farmers in Japan use. You know, they weren't small. They were pretty good sized helicopter, drone type helicopters, like to distribute the fertilizer and that sort of thing over their crops, because the fields there were quite small. So they'd use those, and they use some type of imaging technology to tell where it needed and where it didn't need it. But that was pretty interesting to me, since you could do all that. So the farmers themselves didn't do it, but they had professionals that would come out there and do that for them. Because that way they could do what they needed to do remotely without having to get out in the field, and the fields were not big enough for somebody to come in with like a crop duster or something like that to come in and do that sort of work.
Yeah, they do that in the U.S. too. They're getting more and more popular all the time just going out and surveying the land and see where you need what kind of fertilizer, right, or not, or the opposite of that. They do photo reconnaissance where you program in a flight path for them, and it covers the whole field, and you come back with a whole bunch of pictures that get assembled into one enormous picture, and you can just scroll around and look at your whole field just like you were there. And it'll do them all in the morning, at noon, and then the afternoon. And you can tell, see exactly where your crop needs attention, right? Where it's doing really good and where it's not doing so good, and figure out what you need to do to repair it, even for the larger crops. And it's a whole lot cheaper than a full-scale airplane. And you get just as good the gyros that they've got on those that control the gimbal for the camera, the three-axis gimbal. I mean, it holds it just perfectly still when it takes the pictures, so there's no blurry or anything. And you can zoom in and out and get really good granularity on the photos. And then they use them for finding people that are lost, right? That same kind of thing with FLIR, so that at nighttime they can fly a path, and they know they fly paths that they've already flown past in the daytime, and they're not going to run into anything, and they're looking for heat signatures on the ground. So there's just tons of uses for those things. Like ham radio and radio controlled airplanes go very well together, like chocolate and peanut butter. W4DJW.
JC for ID. Yeah, I've been out of the RC business for a long time, but I enjoyed it a lot back in the 70s. Flew a lot of planes and crashed a lot of planes too, back when we were still on 27 megahertz. And then when they got all these transmitters now, they're a lot more bulletproof than they were back in those days. Somebody key up a CB somewhere back in those days, you could tell, because then two or three airplanes would come out of the sky.
Yeah, that was a huge learning curve. They're using spread spectrum now, so you can, so every, you don't even have, they don't even have frequency flags anymore. They go out and find which one's free, and they jump on the one that's free, and somebody else turns on, it finds that one's used up, it'll keep hunting till it finds a free one, and then pair up with its receiver. That's pretty good technology they've got these days. Hard to, it's almost fail-proof. Hard to build something that would intentionally trip it up. I guess you could build something that would do that, but you'd have to put some work effort into it. It wouldn't be like just flipping on an amp on a CB radio and taking them out of the sky anymore. It's not that simple. Well, I'm going to run downstairs. I'm out of water, but it's good talking to you. Haven't talked to you in a while. It's always interesting. W4DJW.
That's the name, and I know you're doing your program. Enjoy that, or work, or whatever. If you enjoy doing it, it's not really work, I suppose. But good talking to you again. That's really interesting things, especially about your antenna setup. That was really cool. I don't think I've ever heard anybody use that type of technology to do that. But it was great talking to you. Have a good afternoon, and hopefully we'll talk to you again soon. W4DJW and 4DJC clear.
Catch you later, Jerry. N4DJC, W4DJW. I enjoyed it.